Conspiracy Theories, Preliminary Draft January 15, 2008, and Kasar Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule. Abstract. Many millions of people hold conspiracy theories. They believe that powerful people have worked together in order to withhold the truth about some important practice or some terrible event. A recent example is the belief, widespread in some parts of the world, that the attacks of 9/11 were carried out not by Al-Qaeda, but by Israel or the United States. Those who subscribe to conspiracy theories may create serious risks, including risks of violence, and the existence of such theories raises significant challenges for policy and law. The first challenge is to understand the mechanisms by which conspiracy theories prosper. The second challenge is to understand how such theories might be undermined. Such theories typically spread as a result of identifiable cognitive blunders, operating in conjunction with informational and reputational influences. A distinctive feature of conspiracy theories is their self-sealing quality. Conspiracy theorists are not likely to be persuaded by an attempt to dispel their theories. They may even characterize that very attempt as further proof of the conspiracy. Because those who hold conspiracy theories typically suffer from a crippled epistemology, in accordance with which it is rational to hold such theories, the best response consists in cognitive infiltration of extremist groups. Various policy dilemmas, such as the question whether it is better for government to rebut conspiracy theories or to ignore them, are explored in this light. The truth is out there. 1. Conspiracy theories are all around us. In August 2004, a poll by Zogby International showed that 49% of New York City residents, with a margin of error of 3.5%, believed that officials of the U.S. government knew in advance that attacks were planned on or around September 11, 2001, and that they consciously failed to act. In a Scripps Howard poll in 2006, with an error margin of percent, some 36% of respondents assented to the claim that federal officials either participated in the attacks on the World Trade Center or took no action to stop them. 16% said that it was either very likely or somewhat likely that the collapse of the Twin Towers in New York was aided by explosives secretly planted in the two buildings. There is also a body of work that collects many interesting examples of conspiracy theories, but without any sustained analytic approach. See, e.g., Michael Barkun, A Culture of Conspiracy, 2003, Daniel Pipes, Conspiracy. For a treatment of conspiracy theories, from the standpoint of cultural studies, see Mark Fenster, Conspiracy Theories. Conspiracy theories are by no means a strictly domestic phenomenon. They can easily be found all over the world. Among sober-minded Canadians, a September 2006 poll found that 22% believe that the attacks on the United States on September 11, 2001 had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden and were actually a plot by influential Americans. In a poll conducted in seven Muslim countries, 78% of respondents said that they do not believe the 9/11 attacks were carried out by Arabs. 6. The most popular account in these countries is that 9/11 was the work of the U.S. or Israeli governments. What causes such theories to arise and spread? Are they important, and perhaps even threatening, or merely trivial and even amusing? What can and should government do about them? We aim here to sketch some psychological and social mechanisms that produce, sustain, and spread these theories, to show that some of them are quite important and should be taken seriously, and to offer suggestions for governmental responses, both as a matter of policy and as a matter of law. The academic literature on conspiracy theories is thin, and most of it falls into one of two classes: 1. Work by analytic philosophers, especially in epistemology and the philosophy of science, that asks what counts as a conspiracy theory and whether such theories are methodologically suspect; 2. A smattering of work in sociology and Freudian psychology on the causes of conspiracy theorizing. Both approaches have proved illuminating, but neither is entirely adequate, the former because the conceptual questions are both less tractable and less interesting than the social and institutional ones, the latter because it neglects newer work in social psychology and behavioral economics, both of which shed light on the causes of conspiracy theorizing. Rather than engaging, see Alan Kruger, What Makes a Terrorist? Kruger believes that low civil liberties cause terrorism, but acknowledges that his data are also consistent with the hypothesis that terrorism causes governments to reduce civil liberties. Of course, the two effects may both occur in a mutually reinforcing pattern. Following Kruger, we assume that low civil liberties tend to produce terrorism, a hypothesis that is supported by the mechanisms we adduce. With the conceptual debates, we will proceed in an eclectic fashion, and mostly from the ground up, hewn close to real examples, and the policy problems they pose. Our main, though far from exclusive focus, our running example involves conspiracy theories relating to terrorism, especially theories that arise from and post-date the 9/11 attacks. These theories exist within the United States and, even more virulently, in foreign countries, especially Muslim countries. The existence of both domestic and foreign conspiracy theories, we suggest, is no trivial matter, posing real risks to the government's anti-terrorism policies, whatever the latter may be. Terrorism-related theories are thus a crucial testing ground for the significance, causes, and policy implications of widespread conspiracy theorizing. As we shall see, an understanding of conspiracy theories has broad implications for the spread of information and beliefs. Many erroneous judgments are a product of the same forces that produce conspiracy theories, and if we are able to see how to counteract such theories, we will have some clues about how to correct widespread errors more generally. Part I explores some definitional issues and lays out some of the mechanisms that produce conspiracy theories and theorists. We begin by discussing different understandings of the nature of conspiracy theories and different accounts of the kinds of errors made by those who hold them. Our primary claim is that conspiracy theories typically stem not from irrationality or mental illness of any kind, but from a crippled epistemology in the form of a sharply limited number of relevant informational sources. Those who hold conspiracy theories do so because of what they read and hear. In that sense, acceptance of such theories is not irrational from the standpoint of those who adhere to them. There is a close connection, we suggest, between our claim on this count and the empirical association between terrorist behavior and an absence of civil rights and civil liberties. When civil rights and civil liberties are absent, people lack multiple information sources, and they are more likely to accept conspiracy theories. Part 2 discusses government responses and legal issues. In light of the discussion in Part I, we address several dilemmas of governmental response to conspiracy theories, such as the question whether it is better to rebut such theories at the risk of legitimating them, or to ignore them at the risk of leaving them unrebutted. Conspiracy theories turn out to be especially hard to undermine or dislodge. They have a self-sealing quality, rendering them particularly immune to challenge. We suggest several policy responses that can dampen the supply of conspiracy theorizing, in part by introducing diverse viewpoints and new factual assumptions into the hardcore groups that produce such theories. Our principal claim here involves the potential value of cognitive infiltration of extremist groups designed to introduce informational diversity into such groups and to expose indefensible conspiracy theories as such. I. Definitions and mechanisms. A. Definitional notes. There has been much discussion of what, exactly, counts as a conspiracy theory, and about what, if anything, is wrong with those who hold one. Of course, it would be valuable to specify necessary and sufficient conditions for such theories, in a way that would make it possible to make relevant distinctions. We bracket the most difficult questions here, and suggest more intuitively that a conspiracy theory can generally be counted as such if it is an effort to explain some event or practice by reference to the machinations of powerful people, who have also managed to conceal their role. This account seems to capture the essence of the most prominent and influential conspiracy theories. Consider, for example, the view that the Central Intelligence Agency was responsible for the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, that doctors deliberately manufactured the AIDS virus, that the 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800 was caused by a U.S. military missile, that the theory of global warming is a deliberate fraud, that the Trilateral Commission is responsible for important movements of the international economy, that Martin Luther King Jr. was killed by federal agents, that the plane crash that killed Democrat Paul Wellstone was engineered by Republican politicians, that the moon landing was staged and never actually occurred. Of course, some conspiracy theories, under our definition, have turned out to be true. The Watergate hotel room used by Democratic National Committee was, in fact, bugged by Republican officials operating at the behest of the White House. In the 1950s, the Central Intelligence Agency did, in fact, administer LSD and related drugs under Project MKUltra, in an effort to investigate the possibility of mind control. Operation Northwoods, a rumored plan by the Department of Defense to simulate acts of terrorism and to blame them on Cuba, really was proposed by high-level officials, though the plan never went into effect. In 1947, space aliens did, in fact, land in Roswell, New Mexico, and the government covered it all up. Well, maybe not. Our focus throughout is on false conspiracy theories, not true ones. Our ultimate goal is to explore how public officials might undermine such theories, and, as a general rule, true accounts should not be undermined. Within the set of false conspiracy theories, we also limit our focus to potentially harmful theories. Not all false conspiracy theories are harmful. Consider the false conspiracy theory, held by many of the younger members of our society, that a secret group of elves, working in a remote location, under the leadership of the mysterious Santa Claus, make and distribute presents on Christmas Eve. This theory is false, but is itself instilled through a widespread conspiracy of the powerful parents who conceal their role in the whole affair. Consider too the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy. It is an open question whether most conspiracy theories are equally benign. We will suggest that some are not benign at all. Under this account, conspiracy theories are a subset of the large category of false beliefs and also of the somewhat smaller category of beliefs that are both false and harmful. Consider, for example, the beliefs that prolonged exposure to sunlight is actually healthy and that climate change is neither occurring nor likely to occur. These beliefs are, in our view, both false and dangerous, but as stated, they do not depend on or posit any kind of conspiracy theory. We shall see that the mechanisms that account for conspiracy theories overlap with those that account for false and dangerous beliefs of all sorts, including those that fuel anger and hatred. But as we shall also see, conspiracy theories have some distinctive features, above all because of their self-sealing quality. The very arguments that give rise to them and account for their plausibility make it more difficult for outsiders to rebut or even to question them. Conspiracy theories generally attribute extraordinary powers to certain agents, to plan, to control others, to maintain secrets, and so forth. Those who believe that those agents have such powers are especially unlikely to give respectful attention to debunkers, who may, after all, be agents or dupes of those who are responsible for the conspiracy in the first instance. It is comparatively easier for government to dispel false and dangerous beliefs that rest not on a self-sealing conspiracy theory, but on simple misinformation or on a fragile social consensus. The simplest governmental technique for dispelling false and also harmful beliefs providing credible public information does not work in any straightforward way for conspiracy theories. This extra resistance to correction through simple techniques is what makes conspiracy theories distinctively worrisome. A further question about conspiracy theories, whether true or false, harmful or benign, is whether they are justified. Justification and truth are different issues. A true belief may be unjustified, and a justified belief may be untrue. I may believe, correctly, that there are fires within the earth's core, but if I believe that because the god Vulcan revealed it to me in a dream, my belief is unwarranted. Conversely, the false belief in Santa Claus is justified because children generally have good reason to believe what their parents tell them and follow a sensible heuristic. If my parents say it, it is probably true. When children realize that Santa is the product of a widespread conspiracy among parents, they have a justified and true belief that a conspiracy has been at work. Are conspiracy theories generally unjustified? Under what conditions? Here there are competing accounts and many controversies in epistemology and analytic philosophy. We take no final stand on the most difficult questions here, in part because the relevant accounts need not be seen as mutually exclusive. Each accounts for part of the terrain. However, a brief review of the possible accounts will be useful for our later discussion. Karl Popper famously argued that conspiracy theories overlook the pervasive unintended consequences of political and social action. They assume that all consequences must have been intended by someone. The basic idea is that many social effects, including large movements in the economy, occur as a result of the acts and omissions of many people, none of whom intended to cause those effects. The Great Depression of the 1930s was not self-consciously engineered by anyone. Increases in the unemployment or inflation rate, or in the price of gasoline, may reflect market pressures rather than intentional action. Nonetheless, there is a pervasive human tendency to think that effects are caused by intentional action, especially by those who stand to benefit, the sui bono maxim, and for this reason conspiracy theories have considerable but unwarranted appeal. On one reading of Popper's account, those who accept conspiracy theories are following a sensible heuristic, to the effect that consequences are intended. That heuristic often works well, but it also produces systematic errors, especially in the context of outcomes that are a product of social interactions among numerous people. Popper captures an important feature of some conspiracy theories. Their appeal lies in the attribution of otherwise inexplicable events to intentional action and to an unwillingness to accept the possibility that significant adverse consequences may be a product of invisible hand mechanisms, such as market forces, or evolutionary pressures, or of simple chance, rather than of anyone's plans. A conspiracy theory posits that the social outcome evidences an underlying intentional order, overlooking the possibility that the outcome arises from either spontaneous order or random forces. Popper is picking up on a still more general fact about human psychology, which is that most people do not like to believe that significant events were caused by bad or good luck, and much prefer simpler causal stories. Note, however, that the domain of Popper's explanation is quite limited. Many conspiracy theories, including those involving political assassinations and the attacks of 9/11, point to events that are indeed the result of intentional action, and the conspiracy theorists go wrong not by positing intentional actors, but by misidentifying them. A broader point is that conspiracy theories overestimate the competence and discretion of officials and bureaucracies, who are assumed to be able to make and carry out sophisticated secret plans, despite abundant evidence that in open societies government action does not usually remain secret for very long. Recall that a distinctive feature of conspiracy theories is that they attribute immense power to the agents of the conspiracy. The attribution is usually implausible, but also makes the theories especially vulnerable to challenge. Consider all the work that must be done to hide and to cover up the government's role in producing a terrorist attack on its own territory, or in arranging to kill political opponents. In a closed society, secrets are not difficult to keep, and distrust of official accounts makes a great deal of sense. In such societies, conspiracy theories are both more likely to be true and harder to show to be false in light of available information. But when the press is free, and when checks and balances are in force, government cannot easily keep its conspiracies hidden for long. These points do not mean that it is logically impossible, even in free societies, that conspiracy theories are true. But it does mean that institutional checks make it unlikely, in such societies, that powerful groups can keep dark secrets for extended periods, at least if those secrets involve important events with major social salience. An especially useful account suggests that what makes unjustified conspiracy theories unjustified is that those who accept them must also accept a kind of spreading distrust of all knowledge-producing institutions, in a way that makes it difficult to believe anything at all. To think, for example, that U.S. government officials destroyed the World Trade Center and then covered their tracks requires an ever-widening conspiracy theory, in which the 9/11 Commission, congressional leaders, the FBI, and the media were either participants in or dupes of the conspiracy. But anyone who believed that would undercut the grounds for many of their other beliefs, which are warranted only by trust in the knowledge-producing institutions created by government and society. How many other things must not be believed if we are not to believe something accepted by so many diverse actors? There may not be a logical contradiction here, but conspiracy theorists might well have to question a number of propositions that they seem willing to take for granted. As Robert Anton Wilson notes of the conspiracy theories advanced by Holocaust deniers, a conspiracy that can deceive us about 6 million deaths can deceive us about anything. And then it takes a great leap of faith for Holocaust revisionists to believe World War II happened at all, or that Franklin Roosevelt did serve as president from 1933 to 1945, or that Marilyn Monroe was more real than King Kong or Donald Duck. This is not, and is not to be intended to be, a general claim that conspiracy theories are unjustified or unwarranted. Much depends on the background state of knowledge-producing institutions. If those institutions are generally trustworthy, in part because they are embedded in an open society with a well-functioning marketplace of ideas and free flow of information, then conspiracy theories will generally, which is not to say always, be unjustified. On the other hand, individuals and societies with systematically malfunctioning or skewed institutions of knowledge, say, individuals who live in an authoritarian regime lacking a free press, may have good reason to distrust all or most of the official denials they hear. For these individuals, conspiracy theories will more often be warranted, whether or not true. Likewise, individuals embedded in isolated groups or small, self-enclosed networks who are exposed only to skewed information will more often hold conspiracy theories that are justified relative to their limited informational environment. Holocaust denials might themselves be considered in this light. When isolated groups operate within a society that is both wider and more open, their theories may be unjustified from the standpoint of the wider society, but justified from the standpoint of the group if it maintains its isolation. In these situations, the problem for the wider society is to breach the informational isolation of the small group or network, a problem we discuss below. On our account, a defining feature of conspiracy theories is that they are extremely resistant to correction, certainly through direct denials or counter-speech by government officials. Those who accept such theories believe that the agents of the conspiracy have unusual powers, so that apparently contrary evidence can usually be shown to be a product of the conspiracy itself. Conspiracy theories display the characteristic features of a degenerating research program, in which contrary evidence is explained away by adding epicycles and resisting falsification of key tenets. Some epistemologists argue that this resistance to falsification is not objectionable if one also believes that there are conspirators deliberately attempting to plant evidence that would falsify the conspiracy theory. However that may be, as a philosophical matter, the self-sealing quality of conspiracy theories creates serious practical problems for government. Direct attempts to dispel the theory can usually be folded into the theory itself as just one more ploy by powerful machinators to cover their tracks. A denial may, for example, be taken as a confirmation. In this way, conspiracy theories create challenges that are distinct from those posed by false but dangerous beliefs. Recall the belief that prolonged exposure to sunlight is good for you, or that climate change is not occurring. Accordingly, we will focus on indirect means of undermining such theories, principally by breaking up the closed informational networks that produce such theories. So far we have discussed some epistemological features of conspiracy theories in the abstract. We now turn to the sociology of conspiracy theorizing, examining the mechanisms by which such theories arise and expand. B. How conspiracy theories arise and spread. 1. Crippled epistemologies. Why do people accept conspiracy theories that turn out to be false and for which the evidence is weak or even non-existent? It is tempting to answer in terms of individual pathology. Perhaps conspiracy theories are a product of mental illness, such as paranoia or narcissism. And indeed, there can be no doubt that some people who accept conspiracy theories are mentally ill and subject to delusions. But we have seen that in many communities, and even nations, such theories are widely held. It is not plausible to suggest that all or most members of those communities are afflicted by mental illness. The most important conspiracy theories are hardly limited to those who suffer from any kind of pathology. For our purposes, the most useful way to understand the pervasiveness of conspiracy theories is to examine how people acquire information. For most of what they believe that they know, human beings lack personal or direct information. They must rely on what other people think. In some domains, people suffer from a crippled epistemology, in the sense that they know very few things, and what they know is wrong. Many extremists fall in this category. Their extremism stems not from irrationality, but from the fact that they have little relevant information, and their extremist views are supported by what little they know. Conspiracy theorizing often has the same feature. Those who believe that Israel was responsible for the attacks of 9/11, or that the Central Intelligence Agency killed President Kennedy, may well be responding quite rationally to the informational signals that they receive. Consider here the suggestive fact that terrorism is more likely to arise in nations that lack civil rights and civil liberties. An evident reason for the connection is that terrorism is an extreme form of political protest, and when people lack the usual outlets for registering their protest, they might resort to violence. But consider another possibility: when civil rights and civil liberties are restricted, little information is available, and what comes from government cannot be trusted. If the trustworthy information justifies conspiracy theories and extremism, and, therefore, violence, then terrorism is more likely to arise. 2. Rumors and speculation. Of course, it is necessary to specify how, exactly, conspiracy theories begin. Some such theories seem to bubble up spontaneously, appearing roughly simultaneously in many different social networks. Others are initiated and spread, quite intentionally, by conspiracy entrepreneurs who profit directly or indirectly from propagating their theories. An example in the latter category is the French author Thierry Meyssan, whose book 9/11, The Big Lie, became a bestseller and a sensation for its claims that the Pentagon explosion on 9/11 was caused by a missile fired as the opening salvo of a coup d'état by the military-industrial complex rather than by American Airlines Flight 77. Some conspiracy entrepreneurs are entirely sincere, others are interested in money or power or in achieving some general social goal. Still, even for conspiracy theories put about by conspiracy entrepreneurs, the key question is why some theories take hold, while many more do not, and vanish into obscurity. Whenever a bad event has occurred, rumors and speculation are inevitable. Most people are not able to know, on the basis of personal or direct knowledge, why an airplane crashed, or why a leader was assassinated, or why terrorist attacks succeeded. In the aftermath of such an event, numerous speculations will be offered, and some of them will likely point to some kind of conspiracy. To some people, those speculations will seem plausible, perhaps because they provide a suitable outlet for outrage and blame, perhaps because the speculation fits well with other deeply rooted beliefs that they hold. Terrible events produce outrage, and when people are outraged, they are all the more likely to attribute those events to intentional action. In addition, antecedent beliefs are a key to the success or failure of conspiracy theories. Some people would find it impossibly jarring to think that the CIA was responsible for the assassination of a civil rights leader. That thought would unsettle too many of their other judgments. Others would find those other judgments strongly supported, even confirmed, by the suggestion that the CIA was responsible for such an assassination. Compare the case of terrorist attacks. For most Americans, a claim that the United States government attacked its own citizens for some ancillary purpose would make it impossible to hold on to a wide range of other judgments. Clearly, this point does not hold for many people in Islamic nations, for whom it is far from jarring to believe that responsibility lies with the United States or Israel. Here, as elsewhere, people attempt to find some kind of equilibrium among their assortment of beliefs, and acceptance or rejection of a conspiracy theory will often depend on which of the two leads to equilibrium. Some beliefs are also motivated, in the sense that people are pleased to hold them or displeased to reject them. Acceptance, or for that matter rejection, of a conspiracy theory is frequently motivated in that sense. Reactions to a claim of conspiracy to assassinate a political leader, or to commit or to allow some atrocity either domestically or abroad, are often determined by the motivations of those who hear the claim. These are points about individual judgments, bracketing social influences. But after some bad event has occurred, those influences are crucial, for most people will have little or no direct information about its cause. How many people know, directly or on the basis of personal investigation, whether Al-Qaeda was responsible for the 9/11 attacks, or whether Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy on his own, or whether a tragic death in an apparent airplane accident was truly accidental? Inevitably, people must rely on the beliefs of other people. Some people will require a great deal of evidence in order to accept a conspiracy theory, others will require much less. People will therefore have different thresholds for accepting or rejecting such a theory, and for acting on the basis of the theory. One way to meet a relevant threshold is to supply direct or indirect evidence. Another way is simply to show that some, many, or most trusted people accept or reject the theory. These are the appropriate circumstances for social cascades, in particular informational cascades, whose dynamics help to explain the pervasive acceptance of conspiracy theories. 3. Conspiracy cascades. 1. The role of information. To see how informational cascades work, imagine a group of people who are trying to assign responsibility for some loss of life. Assume that the group members are announcing their views in sequence. Each member attends, reasonably enough, to the judgments of others. Andrews is the first to speak. He suggests that the event was caused by a conspiracy of powerful people. Barnes now knows Andrews's judgment, She should certainly go along with Andrew's account if she agrees independently with him. But if her independent judgment is otherwise, she would, if she trusts Andrew's no more and no less than she trusts herself, be indifferent about what to do, and she might simply flip a coin. Now turn to a third person, Charlton. Suppose that both Andrews and Barnes have endorsed the conspiracy theory, but that Charlton's own view, based on limited information, suggests that they are probably wrong. In that event, Charlton might well ignore what he knows and follow Andrews and Barnes. It is likely, after all, that both Andrews and Barnes had evidence for their conclusion, and unless Charlton thinks that his own information is better than his, he should follow their lead. If he does, Charlton is in a cascade. Of course Charlton will resist, if he has sufficient grounds, to think that Andrews and Barnes are being foolish. But if he lacks those grounds, he is likely to go along with them. Now suppose that Charlton is speaking in response to what Andrews and Barnes did, not on the basis of his own information, and also that later people know what Andrews, Barnes, and Charlton said. On reasonable assumptions, they will reach the same conclusion regardless of their private information, which, we are supposing, is relevant but inconclusive. This will happen even if Andrews initially speculated in a way that does not fit the facts. That initial speculation, in this example, can start a process by which a number of people are led to participate in a cascade, accepting a conspiracy theory whose factual foundations are fragile. Of course the example is highly stylized, and in that sense unrealistic. Conspiracy cascades arise through more complex processes, in which diverse thresholds are important. In a standard pattern, the conspiracy theory is initially accepted by people with low thresholds for its acceptance. Sometimes the informational pressure builds to the point where many people, with somewhat higher thresholds, begin to accept the theory too. As a real-world example of a conspiracy cascade, consider the existence of certain judgments about the origins and causes of AIDS, with some groups believing, implausibly, that the virus was produced in government laboratories. These and other views about AIDS are a product of social interactions, and in particular of cascade effects. Conspiracy cascades, too, the role of reputation. Conspiracy theories do not take hold only because of information. Sometimes people profess belief in a conspiracy theory, or at least suppress their doubts, because they seek to curry favor. Reputational pressures help account for conspiracy theories, and they feed conspiracy cascades. In a reputational cascade, people think that they know what is right, or what is likely to be right, but they nonetheless go along with the crowd in order to maintain the good opinion of others. Suppose that Albert suggests that the Central Intelligence Agency was responsible for the assassination of President Kennedy, and that Barbara concurs with Albert, not because she actually thinks that Albert is right, but because she does not wish to seem, to Albert, to be some kind of dupe. If Albert and Barbara say that the CIA was responsible for the assassination of President Kennedy, Cynthia might not contradict them publicly, and might even appear to share their judgment. Not because she believes that judgment to be correct, but because she does not want to face their hostility or lose their good opinion. It should be easy to see how this process might generate a cascade. Once Albert, Barbara, and Cynthia offer a united front on the issue, their friend David might be reluctant to contradict them even if he thinks that they are wrong. The apparently shared view of Albert, Barbara, and Cynthia carry information. That view might be right. But even if David has reason to believe that they are wrong, he might not want to take them on publicly. His own silence will help build the informational and reputational pressure on those who follow. Conspiracy cascades. 3. The role of availability. Informational and reputational cascades can occur without any particular triggering event. But a distinctive kind of cascade arises when such an event is highly salient or cognitively available. In the context of many risks, such as those associated with terrorism, nuclear power, and abandoned hazardous waste dumps, a particular event initiates a cascade, and it stands as a trigger or a simple justifying public concern, whether or not that concern is warranted. Availability cascades occur through the interaction between a salient event and social influences, both informational and reputational. Often political actors, both self-interested and altruistic, work hard to produce such cascades. Conspiracy theories are often driven through the same mechanisms. A particular event becomes available, and conspiracy theories are invoked both in explaining it and using it as a symbol for broader social forces casting doubt on accepted wisdom in many domains. Within certain nations and groups, the claim that the United States or Israel was responsible for the attacks of 9/11 fits well within the general narrative about who is the aggressor and the liar. In a series of disputes, and the view that Al-Qaeda was responsible raises questions about that same narrative. Conspiracy theories are frequently a product of availability cascades.